Right? We're starting. Okay. To say our Gemara. What I'd like to do is to start by looking at one of, certainly my old and favorite pieces of the Haggadah, one of those pieces that we've probably chanted and sung since we're kids. This year we are not doing the Haggadah that we did 2 years ago, but I'd like to start dealing with Dayenu. Dayenu is a part of the Haggadah that we all know and love. And the question is, to what degree do we treat it in a very serious manner, or do we just treat it as a song? Personally, in the Haggadah, I've always found that the more you look for depth, the more you'll find it, no matter how child, folk-like, nursery rhyme-like. I mean, for the record, there are chapters and books on the history and meaning of nursery rhymes. So certainly songs, especially good old Jewish songs, have a lot of meaning to it. But if you take a look at Dayenu, and I'm hoping everyone has opened up Dayenu, so you look at it for a second, you say to yourself, okay, you know, it's a laundry list of things that God did for us. Right? Just glance at it for a second. All these wonderful, wonderful things that God did. Well, I want to try to read it in its most literal fashion, and to try to stretch it, I suppose, in its most sinister way. So let's get started. Ready? We start off, Kama malot tovot makom aleinu. Wow, how many great things God did to us. You know what? If God had only taken us out, but hadn't punished them, dayenu. You know why? Because, who needs punishment? Of course, you know what, God, had you only punished the Egyptians, that would have been enough. You know what, would have made our day. Watch them burn, die, melt, suffer, all their property that we built up for 400 years. This is what Pesach is all about. No, I want to watch them get in pain. No, Dayenu. I would have said, wow, God, just for that, it was worth... No, am I off? Sorry, lo asa Eloheinu. Okay, but you didn't have to destroy their gods too. But what did you do? Ilu asa Eloheinu. You know what you did, God? You got their gods too. You know what? We can't really stand whatever other religions they have and pagans. Yala Dayenu. Okay, no. All right, Harag, you understand the point? Let's go for other ones. It would have been great lo natan lehem b'monam v'lo kara lehem ataya. I'm sorry, can we just play that one through again? God, it would have been enough had you not split the Red Sea for us. Well, what's going to be my issue with that? So exactly what would have happened to us? We would have died on the banks of the river. That's a great idea. This is a great song. I say again, Dayenu, it would have been enough not to have killed the Egyptians. Then, of course, Isaac passes back. We never would have gotten out. Okay, next one. Let's say, God, you had let us... Sorry, the next one. Ilu karelenu etayam, if you had split the sea for us, but lo heavy ranu betoko, but you hadn't let us pass through safely. Also, great movie. The Exodus begins by the Jews leaving people with lots of music, and finishes when the water comes down on both Jews and Egyptians. What a beautiful story. But you understand that that's what Dayenu was saying, no? Am I off? But keep going. What if, God, you had given us Kervanu lifnei har Sinai velo natamanu at Torah? By the way, if you open up Haggadah, open up 200 Haggadahs, this is the one line that everyone's bothered by. What are they so bothered by? You wouldn't have given us the Torah? How could it be that we wouldn't have gotten the Torah? Like, the whole point of Yetzirah Mitzrayim would have been worthless without the Torah. And here we have a song that we teach the little kids. God, if only, you hadn't given us the Torah. Dayenu, it would have been enough. I don't know, in my head that's called heresy, but consider, it's Dayenu, it's okay, it's just a song. Doesn't really mean it, I don't know, maybe it does. Last line. This is the last line, the Zionist line. What's the Zionist line? God, if you had only given us the Torah, but not brought us into Eretz Yisrael. You understand the Zionists go crazy on that line. How could it be that such a thing could exist? That what the purpose of the Jewish people is not to go into Eretz Yisrael. Now, obviously, I'm putting a little tongue-in-cheek into this, and obviously I'm pushing it perhaps a little bit much, but I think the point I'm trying to make is pretty clear. And that is, if I read the song Dayenu literally, it's a little nonsensical. It's a little difficult. Was it really intended to be read this way? And if it wasn't, what in the world was it did intend to mean? Really, Dayenu would have been enough? I mean, do we really mean it? I don't know. I always think that when we daven, we should actually mean what we say. So, Dayenu, we don't really mean it. Really? What are we saying, Dayenu? Okay? Now, I just want to be very clear. If you take a look at your sheet, you look in sources 1. You know, let's read source 1 together. Who's source number 1? Malbim. By the way, I'm going to point out that for any of you that have the English version of the Malbim, this line conspicuously does not appear. It's probably a reason. Says the Malbim, Halo mitoch ha-shevach v'hatila, anu ba'im l'cheruf v'giduf. What's he asking? In all this praise, aren't we coming to like, what's giduf?
Murder.
Not giduf, v'yigad. Remember the guy who got up and cursed God? In Vayikra? In other words, what is this? L'cheruf maratha l'okenu, to contradict the ways of God. Look at this last part of the line. Ki ein lanu fira dola mizu. Says the Malbim. Hear me saying? There's no greater kfira than the song Dayenu. Hey, you would have been good enough had you not given us the Torah. What type of song is this? How can you possibly say, Ki hayalanu dai biladi kol elu? How can a Jew ever say, it would have been good enough had you not given me the next one? If only he had only given me the first couple. The Malbim does not. Again, the Malbim is troubled. The bigger trouble is also how the Malbim explains it, and his son in the footnote says, I'm not really sure how my father answered the question. We'll leave that aside. Sources 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 are all Rishonim and Achronim that translate the word Dayenu in different ways. You know why? It's very difficult. What does it mean? I mean, just for some fun ones. Look at number 4, the Rashba. Rashba's answer is perhaps the strangest. Dayenu. Kilomar dailo la garishbarhu, let's say ide that should be chova, my typo, sha'alav ligmol lano mi'avr mavinu. What did Rashba say? What does Dayenu mean?
You could have fulfilled your promise to Abraham just by doing this one, but you also did that one and that.
Right, so, in other words, God didn't need to do more for Abraham. That's a beautiful song. I mean, what is this, a song to Abraham? In other words, how does this, what that mean to us? Oh, it's about Avram. But you understand, the reason the Rashba says it, because he can't understand how it would have been Dayenu. How would it have been enough? Yeah?
New, I think, for Hafner.
Okay. So what's the name?
It's Dayenu, not Dayenu.
So it's what it, so in other words,
it can't be one person. It must be more than one person.
I got you. Okay, Masada Gomor. Understood the point, yeah?
Well, could you maybe say that really the whole thing about Pesach is the revealing of God to the world, that theoretically God didn't have to do all of this for us because God achieved the purpose of this for his own means. Because he did reveal himself to the world through all the miracles, because the whole thing of Elotzion and Mitzrayim, that was the big thing. And so, and that was the most overt of all the miracles.
Okay, look at number 6. And the tziv is a little bit like what you said. Dayenu. Kfar halenu day bazel havin shalo b'china motzanim Mitzrayim. God didn't just stop and take us out. This wasn't natural. In other words, all these miracles indicate something greater is behind this. It would have been good enough. But the prayer is still difficult. And again, we sing it all the time. And probably, you know, the things that we shuffle the most for and the things that we, say the easiest are very often the things we understand the least. Why do we say that, you know? So, I'll be honest with you. I've always found it to be a good question. Source number 7. Source number 7 is a source I was exposed to 5 or 6 years ago. One more question before we do source number 7. Who wrote that?
We don't
know. It was in Spain.
Well, for sure we don't know. But how would you go about telling me what time period? Can someone looking at Dayenu, can you tell me anything about how old this is? Mm-hmm. Is this a medieval poet? Or is this like pre-Gemara?
Medieval.
Proof. Show me from something. What would indicate to you from Dayenu?
Where it ends.
Where does it end? It ends in the Beit HaMikdash, which presumably means
they were still in the
Mikdash is still around. Otherwise, it's a nonsensical ending. Right? It doesn't make sense. Oh, and you brought us the Mikdash. Yay! Then your kid looks at you. I don't have a Mikdash. What are you talking about?
But if it's really medieval, you still wouldn't want
to. I didn't say medieval. I said this was a long time ago.
I'm saying if you want to get. If these are all positive things, you want to be sure a part at the end of it.
Right, that's why it must be the Beit HaMikdash is still around.
His first
John the second.
Fairly, because you still want to have
to
you'd stop there. You wouldn't put a. If these are all positive, you can start with the negative. He put us in slavery, and then you start with the negative. It's all seem positive.
Okay, I'm just saying, let's put it this way. In order to do that, I would probably want to restructure and reshift a little to do it. Yeah?
So if. if this were written post Korban and Galut, so that the final two, or the final lines wouldn't be there.
Correct.
The two lines?
That's the assumption. Someone, how many Dayanos are there? How many lines are there in Dayanum?
35.
No. Look, don't guess.
14.
14?
14. Yeah.
Including the first. Including the first one, how many are there?
15.
Does that number mean anything to us?
Yeah.
Use one of the words in that opening line. Comma. Malo. What's Malo? What does that remind us of?
Elevation.
Which reminds us of
the steps of the mikvah.
Right, and how many shir hamalots that we set in each step are there?
Yes.
They're also 15. Now, some people want to say that's an indication that at least this was mimicking the time of the mikdash. Of course, it could mimic. By the way, Dayenu is also said responsively, which generally shows that it's older. But it's still not a very good proof. And not just that, so I may know it's old. I still don't understand why we wrote it. One more question, and then I'll take questions. What's the relationship between the paragraph Dayenu and the paragraph that follows it? Halacha kama v'kama. Well, what is that paragraph? Halacha kama v'kama tova mechupelet. What is that paragraph?
Isn't it sort of going through all the stuff that Hashem did for us and how grateful we are?
But what's the relationship between that and Dayenu?
It goes through all the stuff.
It's the exact same thing? Which means there's two paragraphs that say the exact same thing. The difference is, in the first one, it inserts Dayenu. So who needs it? In other words, once you're writing it, why write twice? Or is there a logic that we're writing? Is there something we're doing? Or is there a reason that two people might write the same paragraph with the same things, perhaps in two separate countries at two separate times? But if that would be the case, then I need to know what's the real cause of this paragraph. And now we move to source number 7. What is source number 7? Source number 7, by the way, it's not click well, is going to start our exploration today of the Haggadah. Was not, just like, you know, if I was writing a poem today, or a tefillah today, it's not written in a vacuum. It's written in context, a historical context, a social context, a global context. So is the Haggadah. And what I'm going to try to show you in three or four different ways is that the surroundings of the Gemara, and specifically Christianity, had a hand in the, let's call it, the authorship, in the composer of the Gemara, of the Haggadah. But we're going to try to explain what that means and how that works. There's a scholar named Yisrael Yuval, the scholar of Jewish history at Hebrew U, and he brings attention to the following piece. Okay? One of the, it's called, anyone know how to say that word? Impropira. I'm sure it's a word. On Good Friday. When's Good Friday? That was the one that's Pesach. For the record, that originally was Pesach. We'll get back to that. There's a work, a very famous work that was very famous in the 2nd century. Okay? We have it recorded from three different 2nd century church sources. Someone want to read for me? Yeah, go for it. Go.
Israeli ungrateful, how much did you value the 10 plagues? How much did you value the nightly pillar and the daily cloud and the crossing of the Red Sea? How much did you value the giving of manna from heaven and the supply of water from a rock and the giving of the Torah at Horeb and the inheritance of the land?
Does that sound similar? It's a very curious similarity between this Christian polemic that basically accuses the Jews of being ungrateful and Dayenu. Okay, now let's introduce terms. The term we use is called literary borrowing. It means that someone, presumably, borrowed from someone. Now play this through with me. Which one makes sense? Who's the chicken, who's the egg? Who borrowed from who on this?
The Haggadah borrowed from the Christian stories.
The Haggadah borrowed from them. Why is that? Why?
It's a response.
It's a response. Because it doesn't make sense that we have Dayenu and they look at us and say, you're not grateful. It makes a lot more sense that
we look at them,
they make the accusation and we feel so guilty, or we respond in a way to say we are grateful. Which means that if that's the case, Dayenu was composed in a time where this was famous. Again, we have it in the 2nd century and beyond. Where the Jews felt the accusation that the world around us thinks we're not grateful. So you know what we're going to show them? That we are grateful. Now, if that's indeed the case, I want you now to look back at Dayenu. There are three parts of Dayenu. And I think Dayenu we can now appreciate so much better. Part number one is the title. What's the title?
Kama
Malot. How many wonderful things God did for us. Next, what happens next? 15 or 14, Dieno. And then, has the third part, the second paragraph open? Now, what is al-achat kama v'kama? What's the response?
The response is that, yes, all these things happen to us and we are grateful.
I agree, but I want to go more powerful. What's the structure? All right, let's put it this way. When we talk about tefillah, tefillah, piyut, makes an argument. It starts off at square one, it develops the body of the argument, and then it makes its argument. What's the argument of Dayanu? Yeah?
The second part is saying, if you'd only done these things, it would have been great. So the conclusion is, but the fact that you did all of these things is okay. So much greater.
Everyone follow? In other words, we start off by saying, wow, God did so many great things. He did this. And if he only had done item one, Dayanu, it would have been enough for us to praise him. He also did two. Wow, Dayanu. And guess what happens after we list 15? Al acha kama v'kama.
So the saying, you'll say it.
How much more so, cumulatively, are we thankful for God? We would have had a Haggadah for just one of them. But for all 15, we are the most grateful people in the world.
Unless we had been left in the sea.
Exactly.
Right.
And therefore, as a piyut, this responds and says, listen, it's not that we're ungrateful. We are actually the ultimate grateful people. And we have two whole paragraphs responding. But by the way, I say response, I also mean we're raising to our own consciousness that we apparently need to act more grateful. Now, in the Haggadah, what terms do we have? We have Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. And what happens after Magid? Hallel. Is this Hallel?
No.
Kind of.
Let's put it this way. If it was Hallel, where should this be? It should be in Hallel. Or it should be at the end of Magid. It's smack in the middle. So what is this? It's telling us we need to look in the middle of the story. By the way, what happened right before Diana? Look at the Haggadah. What's the context? Right? Those of you who learn with me, what the context? What is it? What's the drash of the Psukim? Which drash? Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yossi. How many makos? 10? 250? You know why? We appreciate all of them. We appreciate every little thing that God did, because for a couple hundred years, or 100 years, or 5 years, I have no clue, we've been accused of being ungrateful. And perhaps we need to make sure to impress upon our children, or those of the Seder, how grateful we are to God. It's not just about Hallel, about praise. It's about Hakarat HaTov. And that's a very important statement of the Seder. By the way, the other theory that some people want to say is these two paragraphs actually were created independently. Two different times, two different countries, responding to the same thing. Either way, what that means for us in a more global way is that the Haggadah wasn't written in a vacuum. The Haggadah is written knowing what people are saying, what people are thinking, and there's a term. You know the difference between a polemic and an internal polemic? What's a polemic? Let's start there. Polemic is, we are going to polemicize against Christianity by proving they're wrong to their faces. What's an internal, right? The disputation of the Ramban against Pablo Christiani. Internal polemic is, I need to prove to ourselves that we're right. So too. There's one thing to say, I'm going to get up and I'm going to show them that we really are grateful. The other is, I need to build up ourselves. We're a grateful people. And we need to know that. And what that means is that the Haggadah, in a sense, and the term that I use in the title, of influence can go in a lot of different ways. But this paragraph of Dayenu is written to tell us, you know what, people don't think we're grateful. We need to be more grateful. Questions, comments, and thoughts on Dayenu? Yeah?
So I understand that, like you're suggesting, that it's not meant to take literally, like if God had split the sea, then it would have been enough, but... is there maybe some other way of expressing like gratefulness, like instead of more nuanced way, or just like not like it would have been enough even at the expense of dying? Like, why don't I just say, for all these, thank you, or something? Or,
again, I'm sure we could, but what I'm trying to show is that Diana was written, it's hitting it over the head. Saying it in such an extreme way, there's got to be a reason behind it. There is something behind it, motivating it, begging it. We have to go above and beyond to impress this point, because we're apparently losing the battle of being grateful. But you're right. We could have just made a bracha. I could have told you that Hallel is enough. But say Yisrael mi Mitzrayim, yay! apparently that's not enough. And therefore we have to create, and like, and again, Dayenu, almost enough, but it can't just mean it was enough. No, no, no. It would have been enough. We need to be grateful for every little piece that happened. And not just the big picture, also the small picture. Yeah.
So, do you think that it was, like, it was formulated after the Source Number 7 as a response to it, or do you think it was taken from an earlier...
Without knowing that, you know, for all I know, the claim of ungratefulness was 100 years old by the time that was written. Again, historically, you know, for all I know, there was another poem before it was based on. I don't know. But what I do know is that two or three sources from the second century are all saying this, which means the Christian community is all talking about it. And if they're saying it and, you know, as part of their liturgy, they all know it. And if they know it, their Jewish neighbors know it as well. And, you know, it's more of a cultural, communal, it's not necessarily, like, you know, a literary, like, they read this and they said that, but apparently we're being attacked. Apparently it's one of the things, Jews are ingrates, amongst many other bad things Christians used to call us. Yeah?
This isn't going to change anything.
I don't know what that means.
Meaning, saying Dayenu in part of the
correct.
To ourselves during our Seder.
Once again, that was the distinction between polemics and internal polemics.
Right, but the other thing is that if you're trying to argue internally, right,
yeah,
internal polemics, that the way that we're going to fix this, then we have like you said, we have Hallel, we
right.
have the basic bracha of Tefillah, we have Tehillim, we have the Hodus. So we have an entire series of things to internally prove to ourselves that we're not being grateful.
Right. So apparently, at that point, that wasn't enough. Again, Hallel only tells you about the big picture.
I mean, and Hodu. But Hodu is literally half the stuff in Dayenu, pretty much. Sounds like it's almost out of Hodu.
Except that Hodu is not about it. Right. Hodu has all these things about God that we thank him for, but not about every detail of Yitzhak Mitzrayim. And therefore, this is perhaps the first tefillah that goes into the nitty-gritty of every step along the way.
And if that's true, then why do we only say this on Pesach?
What else would you like to say?
Well, the fact that if we're thanking God for Yitzhak Mitzrayim, and that's what we're trying to prove, that we're ungrateful, that you don't
right.
thank him, you don't just thank him once a year for the idea of Yitzhak
Mitzrayim. Sure, on the other hand, that's what the Haggadah and Zibur Tzibur, and my expectations aren't to say this more often, because this is the one day a year, 2 days a year, that we're dedicated towards this. Yeah.
I was just wondering, it's not like...
I also wanted... We have other pieces. Yeah, go for it, though.
Or, like, just that historical... It's, like, interesting to see the order of how they do things and not, like, that applicable with Dayenu, but, like, when Slichot is, like, Huyaninu, like, Hodu, like, do they actually think that was a historical order of whoever wrote it?
Again,
there's sometimes like arguments in Jewish history when certain things happen.
Every case, things are different. In other words, you go back, you look at what are the textual evidence and see what are the oldest sources, and we can figure out the order from within. This, in other words, in terms of Dayenu being put here...
Within
Dayenu?
Obviously, you could argue like Latan Ratimot, Momonam, and then Karal Ratayam. Like, maybe we got the, like, there's some people that say we got the money after the Egyptian wash up and short.
I hear, but I assume that's referring to Chosha. I don't know, but I'm not sure. But it sounds pretty clear. Yeah, last comment. Yeah.
Okay, just to build on what Steve said,
yeah.
why wasn't this put in Halal Mitzvah then?
Halal Mitzvah was established by. We don't have to tell him. But you're right. In other words, I might have expected this to be the introduction to Hallel, except that apparently being grateful and praising are two different things. Remember, we have a difference between Hallel and Hoda'ah. These are two different concepts. Okay, I want to move to the next one, because I want to try to show today, if we can, a number of different models of influence. Okay, let's move to the next one. Next page. Rabban Gamliel Haya Omer. Okay, you see, I stuck to the proofs that I was supposed to do, so we're going to do those. Rabban Gamliel Haya Omer. This is a Mishnah in the 10th Parak of Pesachim. Gemara analyzes it. Tosefta has a similar version to it. Rabban Gamliel Haya Omer. Kol Shelo Omer Shloshet Devarim Elu BePesach VaYatzi Yidei Kovatov VeElu Hein Pesach Matzah Omer. Sounds very simple, no? In other words, says Rabban Gamliel that you don't say these three things, you're not Yotzei Pesach. You're not Yotzei Pesach. Pashut, no? Why is this not a Pashut line? In other words, this sounds like such a simple line. Someone tell me why this is not such a simple line. Someone tell me when you read it. You read it. Again, look at it carefully. Yeah, what do you say, Joe?
Well, maybe... I mean, the one thing that sort of sticks out to me is the order in which she says it, Pesach Matsumar.
Okay.
It's
the Maror Matsumar. So we have together, and there are, that I have to say, there are different versions of that order. Yeah, Warren?
Well, maybe it's that, like, you can do it if you're not, like, focusing on, like, the reason why you're doing it, and you're just kind of going through the motions. It's not. It's like it doesn't count as you actually dying.
Okay, so Warren, focus in for me. What are the words that bother you the most about Ungamliel's statement? Based on what you just said. Lo yatsa hidei chavato. Just think about that for a second. You're not yotze pesach matzu umar unless you do what?
Say
them and explain them. Now, someone using your halakhic background, what do we call that?
Kavana.
And how do we paskin?
It's
not just that. Can somebody tell me a single mitzvah of the 613 you have to say out loud?
Shema.
It has to be Shomei Le'ozna, but you don't have to, it's not an Amira.
I mean, that's not that.
Okay, Maseder. Yeah. That you, but you don't have to say Shema.
Right.
And you don't have to say why you're saying Shema. In other words, yeah?
Where does he say that you need to explain? It says, well,
that's true, but then he then says it, by the way.
Well, yeah, that would just be,
but that's a continuation.
Like, it's muggy, you sort of
tie. Let's put it this way. Every source that we have has this a continuation of Rav Gamliel. Matzah al Shema, you announce it, and you say it.
Okay.
Again, I've just never heard anyone say, ready? Hareini mukhon mazun l'kayim mitzvah asay. Ready, everyone? Matzah!
But it could be that that was...
I've seen that.
It could be that is the actual... filling your and then afterwards,
okay,
it's him going on and explaining it. There's,
so hold on, let me stop you halfway through, and I'm going to ask something you just raised. Ready, everyone? You maybe this is how you fulfill your chovah. Chovah of what?
Of Korban Pesach.
Of Korban Pesach. Or what?
Or of Vehigarat Levin.
Or Yigarat Levin Chan Sipurit Tzim Mitzrayim. Now Sipurit Tzim Mitzrayim at least is an act of talking. So if I don't talk about Karm Pesach, if I don't say matzah, I don't fulfill matzah, what chova are we talking about? Again, this, and when we started off, this seemed like a very simple sentence. It's not so pasha. What obligation? Again, mitzvah say not tzrichas kavana. I don't generally talk for mitzvot.
Well, kavana.
Explain.
Right, well,
what do I need to do on a carpet?
We say karbon every day, and that's sort of...
First of all, that's not a mitzvah d'oraita, that's a zecher. But you were onto something for a second.
You have to dedicate.
Vidoy. One more. What do you do while the act of shchita and hakrava?
You have to say it hard.
All right, Levim in the room, raise your hands. What do we do during a karbon?
Sing.
Only during the...
Now that and during what we're talking Karban Pesach, the halacha is we do shira during Karban Pesach. It's still not an amira al halacha matzah. It's not matzah. It's like karban. Sengus is awful strange. I want to go one step further for a second. Yeah. It's true. Although all I'm going to say is that Rabbi Gamliel doesn't seem to have that interpretation. In other words, when you read Matzah al Shema, you're about to notice he doesn't say that. We'll get there in a second when we talk about the Kohen. Everyone, look for example, just to show you I'm not the only one bothered by this. Look at source number 7, please. Source number 7, are you
cheap? Source number 7 is better. Rubies.
Oh, right. So, the Hebrew source 7 is the Ran. The Ran of Tzavim, again, you know, on Bar Basra we have Mugdi Yosef, but the Ran is his, I don't think it's exactly his Rebbe, but in theory is his you know, the generation before him. Look how he reads this. Call me Shlo Amar Shloshat Dvarim Elu Pesach Le'yatsa Yidei Chavato. Now look at the line that the Ran incidentally bolded. Kolomar, Lo Yatsa Yidei Chavato Kira'ui. What did he add? What does that mean? You didn't do it the way you're supposed to. Did you do it?
Yeah.
Of course, because how can you say you're not Yotze? But you didn't do it the best way. You understand what the Ron's reacting to? He's saying, Rav Yossi, or Gamliel, that's not right what you said. You're right, Kira'ui. The Ron struggles with this. Tosus, by the way, in source 9, he actually says, you know what? I'm actually going to agree with Rav Gamliel. Now look at the conclusion Tosus comes to in source 9. Perish. Ba'amira shetzarech lomar. Apparently there's a mitzvah to say, Pesach zeh shanu ochlin. Ve'itkish matzah lomar. That's just like matzah lomar connected to Karm Pesach. Apparently this is Tosos. There's a mitzvah to say, Pesach matzah lomar al shulma. That's a mitzvah. That is, count that as number, 614, 615, and 616. I only say that because no one else in the world ever counted that as a mitzvah until came along Tosos. When you look at source 10, every Acheron in the book says, what the heck are you talking about closely? I have never heard of a mitzvah of saying this stuff. It doesn't make sense to me at all. Everyone with me so far? Yes? All I'm trying to do is to say that Rabban Gamliel, despite on the surface, seems to be a very simple halakhic idea. When we try to break down the words of Rabban Gamliel, it starts to get halakhically difficult. And here, let me just say one word. We don't always like looking for Christianity and polemics in every little word. But we do like to look for it when something's hinting at us, i.e. when it's not a simple halakhic issue, apparently it's something else. Now, if it's something else, now we have to figure out what it is. Okay. I need you to tell me who Rabban Gamliel is.
He was the Nasi.
He's the Nasi. He's the Nasi. In what time period of history?
During the Korban.
During the Korban?
Before and after.
Before and after. Okay. I mean, not exactly. Can't really work that way. But the hint is, take a look at source number 7, number 11 for a second. I could have brought you source number 11. I could have brought you any academic Haggadah. They all say the same thing. The Rashbetz lived in the 15th century, a Sephardi Acheron, found in the Torah Shlaim, in the Torah Shlaim Haggadah. He says, very simple, look at it. You're holding it?
Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah.
Raise it, just so everyone can see it. Okay. Show it to Miles when he gets back. He was on the board. What?
He saw
before. Perfect. Okay. Look what he says. He says, Rabban Gamliel. Wait, I know that one. Is that the Rabban Gamliel that was alive in the time of the Mikdash? That according to Gemara said he lived 100 years before the Mikdash? Or was it his grandson, Rabban Gamliel, who was nothing after the Mikdash? Which means historically, the Rishonim are already wondering which Rabban Gamliel this was. Now the reason that it's curious to know which Rabban Gamliel this was is because I've heard of something about Rabban Gamliel that that might be very significant. What did anyone know what Rabban Gamliel did?
Oh,
in Bracha. What did he do? Coincidentally, turn the page over. What did he do? Okay, that's not what I was referring to.
The destruction when they're laughing.
Okay, true also.
He would do a Korban Pesach after the Korban.
That's also true. Oh, that was the first Rabban Gamliel, not the grandson.
But I thought the first Korban Gamliel was after, it was before.
That's correct. He's still. You're right, the third one. You're right. I take that back. He established the Olam Al Shinim. Now we need to figure out what this means. Let's put this together. The grandson. Now what I'm going to try to claim, which is by the way not my claim, but there are a number. We'll read inside. Come on. Turn the page. Shimon HaKatan. Just leave. Guys, what I'm going to try to claim to do, and we'll read the Gemara inside. Yes, I know, guys. Shmuel HaKatan wrote it, but Rav Gamliel told him to write it. We'll read the. Here, you know, no one believes me. Source 12. Everyone take a look. Source 12. I'm Rabbi Levi. Berachat Haminim b'Yavne Tiknu. Everyone, source 12, top page on the second side. Berachat Haminim was established in Yavne. Tana Rabbanan, Shimon HaFoklori, Hestir Shimon Eser Brachot. Shimon is the one who established 18 Brachot in front of Ho. B'fnei Rabban Gamliel, Al HaSeder b'Yavne. To be clear, Rabban Gamliel was known as the Nasi of Yavne. And then, alright, we'll get back to this. Right? See the rest of the story? Said Rabban Gamliel, Klum Yesh Adam Shiyadeh L'Takein Berachat Haminim. Everyone with me? He says, does anyone know how to say something against the Minim? Comes along Shmuel HaKatan and he establishes it. I need to now explain what motivated Rabban Gamliel to do Berachat Haminim. And then what I'm going to try to ask you to think about is, how can I relate this Mishnah of the Haggadah to Birkat Haminah? Everyone see what I want to do? Now let's do it. Okay, I need to fill in on history. I don't know what we know about early Christianity. I'm going to give my 1-minute summary of early Christianity. Jesus was a guy. Okay, great. Existed, it's real. Okay. Jesus did not establish Christianity. His students, disciples established a religion. But that religion took hundreds of years to actually be established. Which means that to the same degree that we today have Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionist, Orthodox, Neo-Orthodox, Breslov, Hasidish, Ger, Satmar, and I can keep going. In the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, there were just... Sorry. In the times of the second Beit HaMikdash, there were just as many groups. Okay? We know of, by the way, Dead Sea Scrolls, the Essenes, except the Dead Sea Scrolls seem to disagree with the Essenes, which means there are at least two or three groups. We have groups of Eleitzion. We've got groups called the Pushim and Stukim. We've got Baitusim. We've got at least what we call in the Second Temple period, what we like to say, and certainly in Jewish history, is that since the 19th century, or till the 19th century, the most splinter time in Jewish history was the Second Temple period. There were not a lot of groups. Guess who was one of those groups? Followers of a guy named Yeshu. They were Judeo-Christians. I want to use that term carefully because they were still part and parcel of the Jewish community for a very long time. Until when? In other words, the question that we ask historically, when was the great schism, the great divide between Judaism and Christianity? And there are two markers. The first great marker was the destruction of the temple. Let's start there. That was what I'm going to call the absolute marker. What happened? The Mikdash was destroyed. At that point, how does Christianity or the disciples of Yeshu read the destruction of the temple? God destroyed the Jews. Old Testament, because it's destroyed. And now is the new era of the New Testament. The proof that we're right is that they were wrong and they were destroyed. And at that point, Christianity goes completely independent. But all of you correctly said that Paul had a very important piece before this. Let me explain. Paul's a very important person. Christianity was divided, certainly in the early time period, two different centers. There was the Yerushalmis, right? They spent most of their time fighting with the Stukim. Okay, just to be clear, the earliest anti-Christians were all Stukim, because they were both fighting over what? The Mikdash. Remember? Yeshua was in front of the Mikdash making the speeches. And that's Stuki territory, not Krushi territory. That was the Yerushalmim. But the other group of Christians and early Christians led by Paul said, you know what, I gotta be honest with you. We've been doing this for, I don't know, 80 years. We've been trying to show Jews for Jesus and to try to gain, you know, get people on the bandwagon. And we're still a group of 23 people. We haven't grown in 80 years. It's still the same people. So guess what? It's time to move on. Says Paul, strategically, I'm going to make a new decision. Enough trying to recruit Jews. It's not working. Who am I going to recruit?
Goyim.
Goyim. Pagans. Paul is the first to say, I'm going to set my course. And we have all these wonderful letters of Paul going to all these various barbaric countries and converting people en masse. Now, in order to convert people en masse to Judaism, there are a number of challenges.
Brit Mila.
Okay? The biggest and harshest one is Brit Mila. And then number two is Shomer Negiah. And number three is Milk. Now, therefore, what does Paul decide to do?
Cut those things out.
We are going to, and this is Paul's Chiddush, that for the record within Christianity is a massive machloket within the disciples, but eventually wins because when you bring in the money or the people, you win the religion. And what does they decide to do? Apparently, faith over acts. And therefore, out with the old, in with the new, we are no longer interested. At that point, guess how we react to Christianity? The minute you start calling for abrogation of the law, we call for abrogation of you. And hence comes along Birkat Hamin. We are now in the time period of Rabbi Gamliel. We have all sorts of testimony that Rabbi Gamliel and Paul are contemporaries.
Rabbi Gamliel?
The grandson. Rabbi Gamliel. Seems to, it's Gemara and Shabbos on Tetvav, where Rabbi Gamliel is making fun of the New Testament. Gamliel has a lot to do with early Christianity and dividing the Jewish people from early Christianity. Now let me explain what that means. How does it work in Birkat Hamina? What's the motivation? Why do we put in Birkat Hamina? What does it do?
We're in the world, like they wouldn't say it.
In other words, if you were a disguised early Judeo-Christian and you got up and leave Mincha, you couldn't say it. And therefore, you feel uncomfortable. And you feel, how can I daven with this minion that says these horrible things about the person who I believe is a very important whatever? In other words,
it's directly against Yeshu.
It originally, because min in Chazal in its original means Christian heretic.
This is the Malshinim.
That's correct, and that is not the original version. That's an Ashkenazi censored version hundreds of years later. The original version, the Sephardi version, is the Malshinim. Okay? But you are correct. In other words, our version has been censored because who ran the censor?
Persians.
Okay. And they knew very well this bracha was against them. The only way I know that is because, for the record, we have hundreds of years of anti-Semitism, hundreds of years of papal documentation from the Pope, right? Papal documentation from the Pope about Birkat Haminim and how terrible it is. So they know very well what it is. We're all with me?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what do I want to do? What do I want to claim?
Bring it to Dayenu.
I want to bring it to, no, not Dayenu, but I want to bring it to Amnon Baal. Why in the world would I claim this? And here we need to know something else about Christianity. Guess what Christians do on the night of the 14th of Nisan?
Paschal ceremony.
They do their Paschal ceremony, which we call Easter. Pesach. Now let me be clear. They observe the holiday of
Easter.
On the night of Pesach. You know why?
That's
when it happened. It happened. The Last Supper is what? It's the Seder. Which means that traditionally they observe the same time. Now let me just be very clear. Hundreds of years later, after hundreds of years of infighting, they finally change it. But that takes a very long time. Ready? What do the Christians say in their Seder? You ready? Guys? And we have their sayings. Ready? Look at source number, whatever's next. Source 14. Who's reading? Who's reading? Someone? Yeah, go for it, Harry.
For Christ, our Passover lamb has been sacrificed.
Okay, in other words, who is Karban Pesach?
Jesus.
Next.
Jesus.
And when he had given thanks, he broke it, the matzah, and said, this is my body.
Okay, who is matzah?
Jesus.
Okay, this is a growing trend. Maror.
I have earnestly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer.
Good. In other words, Mara represents, and just be clear, early Christians had Pesach, Matzah, Umarar at their Easter Seder. By the way, in Greek, anyone know what they called it? It's called Pascha. Okay?
They even pronounced it the same way.
Okay. That already, that's an F. It's not a P. It could be PH.
No, it's in Spanish.
Spanish, or no. For those of you with languages, in French, Italian, and Spanish, it still is called pasta. Okay, now, please now someone formulate for me, guys. Formulate for me, therefore, what is Rabban Gamliel saying?
He wants you to know that you're not talking about these three Pesach, Matzah, Maror. You're talking about the Jewish.
And therefore, what is
so? Therefore, you have to explain it.
Yeah.
You think that Pesach is Jesus and Matzah is Jesus and Maror is Jesus?
Good. What do you need to know?
Pesach is she'anu ochlim al shuma.
She'anu ochlim al shuma. This is the only time in the entire history of halacha that we have to explain what we're doing. You know why? Because there's a reason for confusion. Or we want to make sure that when the guy who's too embarrassed to say Birkat Haminim, he should be embarrassed to sit at the Seder with us because we're interpreting it differently than he does. And therefore, this is the only time. Tell me more. Lo yotzei yedei chovato. What does it mean?
Because
you're not one of us. It means get the heck out of here. It means this isn't Pesach for you. You're worthless. This whole thing is worthless. That's not a halachic statement because it's a meaning thing in halacha. It's not a halachic statement. It's not a sensical halachic statement. This is rhetoric. This is Christian, get out of here. You don't belong here. We don't want you here. You're not doing the mitzvah if this is not what you think. And what that might mean is that one of the most pivotal moments of the Seder is actually very much internal polemic to make early Christians uncomfortable, because this was written at a particular time in history, and Rabban Gamliel, we know, wrote Birkat Haminim, and this is in fact the same thing. Bear in mind, it's not a big chiddush to say you need to say these three things on Pesach. In other words, if I had asked all of you in the middle of the night what you need to do on Pesach, anyone that would not have listed this, I don't need Rabban Gamliel to tell me this. But I do need for him to institute it in a way that's going to rise to the challenge of his time period. And that is distinguishing Jew from Christian. By the way, someone go further. Look at now, once you understand what I, once, guys, once we understand what I just said, can someone look at the content of Pesach? Everyone take a look. Pesach al Shuma. Would you, if I had asked you, Pesach al Shuma, what would you have said? Why do we do Korban Pesach? That's what the Haggadah says. Would you have said what the Haggadah says? Look at the Haggadah. Al Shum Shepasach Avotei Bnei Israel. By the way, take a look at source number 17.
Isn't that different than the Gemara in
Israel? Oh, for sure. As I'm telling you, it's not simple, the ones he chose. Look at source 17. By the way, look at source 17 and tell me, why did God Pasach Al Batei Bnei Israel? Because of the blood. Not the carbon.
The blood is from the carbon.
I agree. But when I pick up the carbon and I say, I'm not saying I'm having a meat saturated with blood. Which means very simple. Guys. Which means very simple. He's purposely choosing something. Why is he purposely choosing that? Because he needs to explain.
Jews make
mouth
with blood.
Nah, guys. Just bear in mind. The earliest blood libel is in 1244. It was not popular in England at the time at that point. It arises much greater around 40 to 60 years later. It does not. Sorry, I do have an MA in Jewish history. For the record, take your studies in college. College prep started already. Take your studies seriously and take Jewish history. And then remember what you're at. Why would he pick this? What's he trying to interpret? What's the most important part of the passage, Pesach al Shema? What word is he interpreting?
Pesach.
He's not interested in Korban Pesach. He's interested in saying, don't think Pascha means Jesus' body. Rather, Pesach has to do with the act of skipping over us. Which means that Rabbi Gamliel actually never explains why we eat Korban Pesach.
Right.
He's explaining the terminology. Next, matzah. What would you have said? Halachma anya. What would you have said? Lechem sheh. What did you say before? Onu malach. Is that what he says? Look at matzah. Can someone please explain to me, for Rabbi Gamliel, the significance of matzah? I challenge you.
Oh, it also has to do with
Hashem. Look, what is it?
We didn't have time to rise.
I'm sorry, is there significance to matzah, guys? Is there significance to matzah in and of itself?
No.
It's simply not chametz. Again, we avoid matzah, holy Jesus. All we're saying is the significance of matzah is simply because it's not chametz.
It's also reminiscent with the seif, though, no?
We once ate that there, but not because it's holy, because we didn't have time. Because I need to strip away the holy act, the holy eating of the matzah. Good? Okay. I want to do, for the 5 minutes I have left, I was planning on, I will leave you guys with 18 and 19. 18 and 19 is, here's your challenge. All the rabbis in Bnei Brak, if you ask me, if you look at sources 18 and 19, they copied us. But I'll leave you to read that on your own. In other words, read through the Epistula Apostolorum, or however you pronounce that, which is a much later source than what we have. It has a story. It's based on a piece from the Book of Acts, and it's literally a ripoff of our story. But read it, and you'll figure that one on your own. I want to throw out for you, guys, a couple of possibilities. What do I mean by that? Once we understand that Pesach, because Pesach and Easter are on the same time, and there is confusion, and people are, and that we have this discourse between us and Christianity, I want to throw out 10 quick places that this may pick its head up. And then we may say to ourselves, maybe there's something to it. Let's start with, and I'm just going to run to the Seder. Some of these ideas are stronger than others. But once we start looking for Jewish-Christian influence and discussion, it could be it's all over the place. Halach ma'anya. This is bread, as opposed to
Jesus,
I am bread. This isn't about Jesus, this is about who? What we ate. You know, we're inviting people. What's Christianity, of course, known for? Right, being nice and accepting. And of course, L'shana haba. Why is L'shana haba so important? Because Christianity doesn't believe in L'shana haba. Because he already came. Which means that I may find all sorts of references the more I look. Tell me, Rav Elazar ben Azariah, what does he say? I need to remember Pesach when? Afilu Bimot Mashiach. Which, by the way, is an explicit line in the New Testament. And now that I've mentioned Jesus, I don't need to worry about all the Old Testament miracles. Oh. How about the Russia? What does he say? Who's asking about the Russia? What does the Russia say? Now, ready? Maybe, is the Russia a Christian? Prove to me yes or no. Possibly. First of all, Lachem v'lo-lo. You're hotzi yourself min ha-klal kofer b'ikar. That's a really strong term. We don't do that to most people. But for Christianity, we kick you out. Remember, what does the Russia say? Ma ha-avodah hazot lachem. What does it mean? What's this
to you?
Work to you. Remember, we don't do these acts anymore. Maybe the Russia is Christian. Next, Chacham. What's the answer we get to the Chacham? Strange answer. What do we teach him about? Specifically, Afikomen. And what is Afikomenus in Greek?
Dessert.
Correct. Which, or how about it's the mana, the dish that comes after everything else, which is their way of saying, they're saying Messiah. It's the final end of days. Afikomus, which is all from the same Greek word. We have to explain to him, make sure the Chacham knows the difference between us and them. Next, Mitchila. What's Mitchila? Do we know the paragraph? Okay, and how does it end? Does anyone know how that paragraph ends? After that? Who's the last part of that pasuk? Guys, everyone take a look at Mitchila for 2 seconds. The Yaakov, da-da-da, ve Esav Yarad somewhere. Since when do we care about Esav? It's important for us to say they had their place, they left. Baruch Shomer Avtachato. Why is that important paragraph? God keeps his word.
Because God doesn't go back on his word.
In other words, even though we're destroyed, even though we were enslaved for 400 years, don't worry, God will take us out. You understand that once I start looking for this, I can find it all over the place. Same thing. Why did we go down to Egypt? God made us. Why? Because exile is an act of God, not an act of
rejection.
Vayeda Elokim. What does it say? What does Vayeda imply? The biblical Yada? That the Jews in Egypt were not allowed to have family congenial relations, which of course is something that Christianity is against. We consider it torture, they consider it an ideal. You understand? I keep going. Blood is something we can talk about, and I will end with alluding to Thursday. On Thursday, Professor Tabori will be here to talk about Manashtana. What I'm going to throw out just to think about is, if I had to ask you what number is the key number at the Seder, what number would you say?
Four.
And if you, as you will see, based on Professor Tabori, the original number at the Seder was 3. And the claim is going to be, Yishalmi, is that numbers were changed in the Bavli from 3, because 3 suddenly became a Trinity sign, and everything in the Seder went from 3 to 4. I'll leave you for Thursday, but bear in mind, Kosov, you're right, but Kosov, bear in mind, even the Gemara is not sure if it's 2 groups of 4. Also, I will tell you that many people say the first cup is Kiddush. It's not part of the Dalet Kosov. And there are pieces of Mishnah that talk about that. Okay. Last comment. Only because I'm finished with it. We have one of two choices. One is I can send this to everyone, or the other is I'll leave it here. I would say half of what I said is, I mentioned the name Yisrael Yuval. He's written this in English, he's written in Hebrew, he actually has a book on it. He has a book basically called Polemics and Dialogues in Judaism, going through all different sorts of halachot and things like that. He's got a lot. I will leave this here. As far as I'm concerned, I can send this to everyone. Is that of interest?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
If that's the case, then I need people's email address. So if you already get emails from me, just put your name down so I know you're here. If you don't, just give me your email address. Here, we'll start one on the front, one on the top. I will send this to everyone, anyone interested. And I'll take questions and we'll have to get stuff.
Is there sort of, I guess, a danger to an approach like this? Because it makes it seem as if what we're doing is essentially just a response saying
something very clear.
and I think
what first of all, internal polemics.
This is one copy.
Internal polemics, first of all, are very important. I will tell you that when Yisrael Yuval came out with the book at Beit Marashah and Kiryat Moriah, when I ran a conference on is everything a polemic or is nothing a polemic or is there some medium, Yisrael Yuval wants to read all Pirkei Avos as an anti-Christian polemic. And one of the things I tried to show though is there's different types of polemics and different types of influence. Some of them may be speculation, some may be happy coincidences afterwards, but some are very real. And I wouldn't want to be scared of too much, but sometimes I think it's very real. I know. Gamliel to me and Diana were very solid. There are a couple others that are speculation.
So what about, so would you say reading the entire Haggadah like this is speculative?
I would say that it doesn't make sense the entire Haggadah is anti-Christian, because why would you do that? But every once in a while, they throw in a little shtuk, you know? Like, imagine your Rebbe giving shir and throwing in politics, or throwing in something contemporary. Who doesn't do that? And the point is the Haggadah would do the same as well. Okay, we will stop here.